Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to episode number 234 of Real Life Ghost Stories. And to kick things off this week, I would like to say thanks to some of our newest Patreon subscribers. I would like to thank Sarah Woolman, Sai Soy Candles, Emily Hyder, Sullivan Baker, Christy Bennett, Alexis Porter, Miss Lauren J. McNally, and Mary Lee. Thank you so much for subscribing to the Patreon. I love you and appreciate you every single day. And our film review this week, our film review is You'll Never Find Me. You'll Never Find Me was released in 2023. It has 6.8 out of 10 on IMDb and 80% on Rotten Tomatoes. Patrick is a strange and lonely resident of a mobile home at the back of an isolated caravan park. After a violent thunderstorm erupts, a mysterious young woman appears at his door seeking shelter from the weather. The longer the night wears on and the more the young woman discovers about Patrick, the more difficult she finds it to leave. Soon she begins to question Patrick's intentions, while Patrick begins to question his own grip on reality. Do you know what? I still don't know how I feel about this film. Genuinely. So I watched it the other day. I feel like somebody posted it maybe in the supergroup. Somebody posted about it and I thought, oh, I haven't heard of this film. I'll give it a go. Had a look at Rotten Tomatoes and IMDb and I thought those are pretty decent scores. And generally I don't let the scores dictate what films I watch. But when I'm kind of posting the Instagram and Facebook, I generally obviously will have a look and see what the Rotten Tomatoes scores are. And this seemed quite good. So I was like, right, let's give this a go. It's not a film that I had heard of, but I do feel like it's worth a watch. And I'm probably going to have very little to say about this film because I don't know how much there is to say about it without giving things away. This is the type of film that keeps you asking questions the entire way through. Literally from beginning to end, I was like, who? Wait, is she the bad guy? Is he the bad guy? Are they both the bad guy? Do they actually know each other? I mean, it is a ride and a half, you know? You do not know your arse from your elbow most of the way through this film. And it does that through a lot of subtlety. So I was watching the film. I generally watch the films in the morning. So generally like on a Monday or Tuesday morning, I'm sitting watching really intense horror films. And I kept having to go back and rewind this film because I was like, wait, did I miss something? And I might have missed something like really small, something really subtle that's actually really important for the plot. So just as a word of warning, this film is not a casual watch. I don't feel like you can be scrolling on your phone while you're watching this film. Like, you need to be invested and watching at all times. A lot of the clues and hints and a lot of the storytelling is very visual. And you see little glimpses of things and somebody might pick up an item and you'll go, oh, that's weird. But if you weren't looking in that exact moment, you would miss an entire part of the story. And for somebody like me who has a very short attention span, that took a lot of work, took a lot of effort. It probably took me double the time to watch this film than its actual running time was. So really throughout the film, you only have the two lead actors. So Patrick and the young woman who comes to his door. And I thought the performances of both actors were absolutely fantastic. They were perfect for their roles and I thought they played them exceptionally well. At different times in the film, I was like captivated by them, disturbed by them. I distrusted both of them at various points. And I do think that's a real skill. I thought in terms of the subtlety of the story, it was really well written because, you know, I distrusted Patrick a lot throughout the film. But actually, I had no real reason to distrust him. You know, he would say something that could have two meanings, but then you're thinking, hang on, he said this thing, but does he mean it in a really innocuous way? And I'm reading negatively into it because he's a man who lives on his own. And then I would look at the girl, she would say something, and I would think, oh, hang on a second. Is her origin story real? Like, is she actually telling us that she's just arrived here in the storm and her car is broken down? Like, is that true? And I had real genuine moments throughout the film of distrusting both of them and not knowing who I should be trusting and not knowing how the heck this whole story was going to wind up. And like, fundamentally, I think at its core, it is a good film, maybe. And it sort of brings me to my dislikes. It is a difficult film to keep track of, right? Because it is all expositionary dialogue based. So it is slow. It all happens in this one caravan and it's just the two of them. So it's very intense, very slow. Like I said, it's not a film to take your eyes off because so many little things happen that are visual. You have to concentrate for the entire film. It was a bit of a struggle to keep up with at times. There were times when I was like, wait, what? Sorry, who did that? What did you just say? And I had a thought about it while I was watching it that I don't know whether it's a like or a dislike, but I'm going to put it here anyway. The dialogue in the film often felt like monologues that were fit for a stage. Really kind of existential, deep monologues about life and existence and the things that we do in life, about right and wrong, and they felt jarring in a conversation between two people. And I guess this harks back to when Dan and I watched the film The Lighthouse, which I really disliked for lots of reasons, and Dan said to me, yes, but if these speeches were on a stage, if this was a play, you'd say it was brilliant. And that's something really interesting that I have thought about often when I've watched films like this, where you have these monologues that are really powerful and, you know, existential and wordy and flowery. And you think, God, you know, if I did see that on stage, I probably would say, wow, that was incredible. So all that to say, like, the substance of these speeches were great, and the depth and the richness of the communication between Patrick and the young woman that ends up at his door, it was really interesting. And when I posted this on Instagram, a user called The Woven Emerald commented and said one word, slow. I just didn't feel like the end was worth the suspense. And I kind of agreed. I think it was one of those ones, like with Caveat, that by the end, I was sort of a bit done with the whole fiasco. And I was like, oh, boo-hoo, let's get this over and done with. Like, whatever happens, happens. Just come on, let's get a wriggle on. But the ending was definitely disturbing. You know, there was no two ways about it that the ending was an ending befitting of a horror film for sure. So fundamentally, I don't know how I feel about this film, is the long and the short of it. I wrote down 5 points in my entire likes and dislikes columns, in both of them all together, because I was like, I don't know how I feel about this. I kind of feel like, yes, it is worth a watch. I thought it was quite slow, but I did think the performances of the two actors were pretty amazing. And I just think, you know what, give it a go, give it a try, see if you like it. I'm going to give it 3.5 stars. It's 3.5 stars for You'll Never Find Me. And if you wildly agree or disagree with that, send me a message or leave a comment on Instagram. I'm curious to know what people think of this film. So that's 3.5 stars for You'll Never Find Me.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Which brings us swiftly to our story this week. Now, our story this week, I sort of thought was going to be a really simple story. And it turned out to be absolutely bonkers. It is bananas, this story. We deep dive into every conceivable theory and every tenuously linked possibility within this particular story. And my information for today's story comes from a book called The Baron of Rainbow Bridge by Paul Owens, who has spent 40 years researching this particular case. And you can see it in the book because he covers every single base thoroughly. Every single possibility is investigated to within an inch of its life. So let's get into the story. If you've had a pet, you will understand both the joy and absolute frustration that they bring to our lives. We love them, and they simultaneously manage to drive us absolutely bananas. They have this special ability to always get it wrong at the most inopportune moment. Your dog will wait until the end of the month to swallow a sock, just when you are living on your last few pennies. But they are there all the time, and they are family. For me, in the darkest period of my life, having a pet meant a routine, it meant consistency, and it meant purpose. You may have recognized the name of this episode, and you may not be able to place exactly where you've heard it from. This episode comes with a trigger warning. Today we are going to be discussing Overton Bridge, the bridge in Scotland where dogs mysteriously throw themselves off. These dogs are pets. They were and are a part of someone's family. For most, they were simply out for a walk and the unthinkable happened. I promise I will not go into gory details, but at this point you may not wish to continue listening. To be clear, this story is not just about dogs throwing themselves off bridges, and like I said, there will be no gory details. There is a wider context and a wider narrative around it. I will cover the facts of the dogs jumping early in the narrative, so you can skip that bit if you wish. But this is a story of mysterious objects embedded in the bridge, of evil and alchemy, of strange energies and phantoms. During this episode, we will be diving into the work of Paul Owens and his book, The Baron of Rainbow Bridge, which he researched for 40 years. As I said, let's talk about the facts around dogs and Overton Bridge. It is estimated that 100 dogs have jumped from the bridge since its completion in 1895. Some estimate that the figure is closer to 600, while others estimate that it is over 100. Whatever the true number is, it is a fact that an alarming number of dogs have jumped from this Scottish bridge. At least 50 dogs have jumped since 1950 alone, and in one six-month period in 2005, five dogs jumped from the bridge. In the 1950s, a woman named Jessie Forrester moved to the area. She was the head of the Scottish Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals, and her husband was a doctor. From the moment she arrived in the area, she and her husband were advised by the locals to keep their dogs on their leads when walking over or around Overton Bridge. She stated, "I never liked that bridge, so I always put my dogs on a lead there. It's a heck of a long way down if they jumped up on that wall, and I have at no time had a dog not on a lead there. I walked my Labradors there for years, but I would never have had them off a lead over that stretch." In 1999, Mr. Ian Fisher, a retired police officer, set up a dog walking business, and his first client was a black and white border collie named Jess. No matter what he did, Jess refused to walk over the bridge. They went on countless walks together, but she never walked over that bridge. Perhaps she sensed something that she didn't like. In 2005, journalist and editor William Cochran caught wind of the dogs at Overton Bridge and published a series of articles. With each article, more people came forward with their own experiences of the bridge, and the story grew and grew until it achieved global recognition. There are obviously many claims about the bridge, one being that the dogs only jump off one side of the bridge and only from one single parapet, but that is not true. Dogs have jumped from all parts of the bridge and at all times of the year, and according to canine behaviourist Joyce Stewart, dogs generally would not jump over a wall unless they were aware of what was on the other side. There have, of course, been recorded instances of dogs jumping off other bridges all over the world. But these are isolated incidents, and none have seen the huge numbers that Overton Bridge has seen. If it makes you feel any better, there are lots of cases where dogs have taken the jump off Overton Bridge and survived. But of course, the question is why? What is it about this place that has compelled this behaviour from dogs, and is the answer really paranormal? Overton Castle was completed in 1863, and it is a dark grey imposing citadel. It's beautiful and striking, yes, but it also has an air of glooming mystery and darkness. Baron Overton, whose name was John Campbell White, had fought for years to obtain enough land to build a driveway and a bridge for the house. Baron Overton was obsessed with this bridge, and he hired Westminster architect Henry Ernest Milner to design it. The bridge and driveway cost almost £2 million to build in today's money. 3 years after its commencement, the bridge was complete and resplendent. Baron Overton was a deeply religious man, and he believed that this bridge brought him closer to God. That God had granted him the means and the ability to complete this bridge, a bridge which his father had dreamed of building. The joy he felt about the completion of the bridge would bring him closer to God. He believed that the bridge had been built through his prayer and contemplation. Never mind, of course, the scores of men who undertook back-breaking work and put their literal blood, sweat and tears into the job. On Friday the 7th of June 1895, a crowd gathered to witness the dedication of the bridge. Baron Overton wished for it to be dedicated to God, and that the bridge would be a holy walkway, and the crowd, which consisted of prestigious men from the area, watched as the bridge was blessed by a clergyman. The bridge was a rainbow bridge that connected heaven and earth. As was customary, Lady Overton laid the final stone. But there were two problems. The inscription of the stone read, "Last stone of the bridge laid by Lady Overton, and avenue opened on the 5th of June 1895. And that was just untrue. It was the 7th of June. Secondly, tucked away in the crevice that the stone was slotted into was a bag. And in this bag was a hoard of coins, some newspapers, photos of the Overtons, a book and a letter on which there were the following words: "Every house is builded by some man, and he that built all things is God." To understand why the building of the bridge was so important, we need to understand where the money came from to build that bridge. Baron Overton spent millions of pounds to complete this project. His father had dreamed of procuring the land to build the castle, the driveway and the bridge, and of course I have laboured the importance of religion and God and godliness for the Overtons. But that didn't stretch to their business ventures and how they made their money. Jay and Jay White's chemical works were in Rutherglen, and they produced bichromate of potash for the use of dye, tanning and pigment. The Overtons became unimaginably rich, while their workers became unimaginably sick. They entered the factory, gaunt and snow white, and left the factory covered in a pale yellow chemical dust. The Overton father and son believed that the factory was too a gift from God, and that the men working in it should be grateful to have the opportunity to be so close to God. They would scrutinize the men leaving the factory and bellow at them to return and return any chemical residue into their vats, terrified of the loss of a single penny. The factory experimented with the manufacturing of chrome crystals, which were a veritable gold mine, but they were a death sentence for the men that worked with them. The crystals wore away the men's skin, leaving gaping wounds. They worked in clouds of vitriolic acid and poisonous chrome dust, and they were slowly and torturously dying because of it. The Overtons knew this was happening. They literally saw these men melting away day after day, their lungs corrupted and their flesh dissolving. But they simply didn't care. They had money to make. And I can assure you now that the suffering of these men has not been exaggerated for effect in this story. A man named John Campbell, who worked with the chrome crystals, had a belly that was, quote, so eaten with holes that he was in torture when his shirt or trousers touched it, and so he got a wire cage affair made, which he wore next to his skin to keep his clothes from rubbing. Men lost their limbs, and when they couldn't work anymore, they were simply cast out onto the streets with nothing. Baron Overton would walk past these men and leave the factory to preach the word of God at a Christian institute he had set up. Inspectors came to inspect the factory, having heard rumours of the treatment of the workers, and were horrified to see that the waste from the factory was oozing into the River Clyde, turning it into an unlivable cesspit. But it wasn't just the men in the factory or the surrounding foliage that was being killed by the crystals. When the men left the factories at night, they brought those crystals home with them, on their clothes, on their skin, in their hair. The sickness spread to their families and their loved ones like a plague. And things began to change for the Overtons. The tide began to turn. The huge manor houses that they had bought close to the factories began to crack and crumble, literally. Their land and their woods began to wither and die. Large fissures appeared in the grounds of the factories themselves. What the Overtons hadn't realised is that a mining company had been quietly mining the land all around the factory and had been mining deep underneath the factory. The empire was crumbling. Baron Overton's father died, and Baron Overton then commenced the building of his sacred bridge. The money used to build the bridge, and indeed the money that was hidden inside the bridge itself, had been earned from the horrific suffering of innocent men and earned from the absolute destruction of land. Keir Hardie, the leader of the Labour Party, stated, "While Lord Overton conducts family worship at Overton House, his white chrome eater victims toil and sweat in the malaria hole at Shawfield, adding to the wealth of their sainted master. While they murder their bodies, he prays for their souls, as if God was not also the maker of the body." There are many who believe that the bridge was cursed from the beginning. It was created with money that was made from men who suffered and laboured. Somehow the Overtons turned their back on humanity and built the bridge in the name of God, all while they watched men suffer and die for them. Some believe that the darkness seeped into each stone and that dogs can somehow sense this energy, that they are driven to jump over the parapet in confusion and fear. There are some dog owners who have witnessed this phenomenon who have said that they saw a strange shadow looming on the bridge and that their dogs reacted in sheer terror and flung themselves over the bridge in a vain attempt to get to safety. But that isn't the end of the story. Nor is it the end of Baron Overton's story. He believed that he had been chosen by God. He believed that he had a divine purpose on earth and needed to convince the other members of the Christian Institute that this was the case. He began to sign his letters off as I am, which is what God is referred to in Exodus. He lived a bizarre life of duality. He banned smoking in his factories, yet built a luxurious smoking room in his castle. He banned alcohol from his house and factories, but secretly funded a club that provided high-end alcohol to the wealthy. He ignored the health and well-being of his workers and simultaneously made charitable donations to the Hospital for Skin Diseases in Glasgow. And in a strange turn of events, he became completely obsessed with alchemy and believed that he and his associates could find a way to turn metal into gold. A practice that was completely forbidden in his Calvinist Christianity. And he pumped thousands into the endeavour, millions in today's money. And soon after his deep dive into the world of alchemy, on the 15th of February 1908, the Baron developed pleuropneumonia and died. And even still, our story doesn't end there. The Overton estate has borne witness to several deaths. When the castle was first being constructed, the job had been entrusted to famous architect James Smith. James was a well-respected architect, until his daughter Madeline had been accused of murdering her lover with arsenic. And after this, James and his family were shunned. The Overton castle job was like a lifeline for him, but he grew completely unhealthily obsessed with it, devoting every single waking second to the design and construction of the building. His health began to deteriorate, and he still insisted on working on the project until eventually he died, and never got to see the castle completed, despite devoting every second of his life to it, ignoring everything else in his life. The job was handed over to a promising young architect, Robert Grieve Melvin, who was one of the city's up and coming, with a bright future. His career in architecture mysteriously plummeted when he took on the role in Overton. He literally disappeared from the job, and was eventually found working as a hotel keeper. He refused to go back into architecture or ever explain what had caused him to leave the role in Overton. In 1902, Baron Overton was shooting with companions when he accidentally shot Irishman David Porterfield in the leg. Porterfield was a worker in the estate and he later died of his injuries. In 1932, gamekeeper Andrew Hutton died when he stumbled over a cliff edge while trying to shoot a hawk. Interestingly, the lodgekeeper at the estate, Mr. Johns, reported feeling an inexplicable, invisible force pushing him when he'd been standing near the cliff edge. In 1962, a 24-year-old Lance Corporal named Bill Swanson went missing after he had gone to hunt rabbits around the Overton estate. When he didn't return, a search party was mounted. He was found deep in a wood that was not his intended destination. He had died by apparent suicide. In 1986, a taxi driver named Alexander Murray was found dead in his car in the Overton estate. In 1994, a father was charged with murder after he threw his newborn baby off the bridge. He tried to throw himself off the bridge not long afterwards. The details of this story are harrowing, and I will not be going into detail here, but the information is all readily available online should you wish to look it up. In the 1980s, the Overton estate was occupied by a man named Mr. Les Turner, who believed himself to be a deliverance missionary and performed multiple exorcisms in Overton Castle. There are those who believe that the land itself, including the castle and the bridge, is cursed. Many locals attest to the atmosphere at Overton being dark and suffocating. People who have gone to the bridge to film and record have had their equipment repeatedly malfunction without any obvious cause. So what is happening at Overton? What is the cause of at least 100 dogs jumping inexplicably to their deaths? The first theory is the dripping theory, which posits that dogs can hear dripping or cascading water from inside the bridge itself. Dogs are generally naturally curious, so it is possible that they could be jumping in response to the sound of water from inside the bridge. This theory certainly holds water. Sorry, I couldn't resist that one. But many dogs have jumped on dry days where there has not been rain for some time, which makes this theory less believable. There is also the waterfall theory, which suggests that dogs can hear the roar of a nearby waterfall, which drives them to a frenzied excitement, causing them to seemingly inexplicably jump from the bridge. This theory is supported by some of the dog owners who have experienced the terrible phenomenon. But if this is the case, then it seems to only be happening at Overton Bridge, despite the fact that there are countless other similar bridges with waterfalls all over the UK. There are some who believe that the dogs are responding to low-pitched frequencies used by the Navy to communicate with submarines that are known to use the river nearby. And similarly, some believe that it is a low-frequency hum that is emitted from nearby power lines that is causing the dogs to behave strangely. Or is infrasound generated by the wind howling through the bridge, causing frequencies that are impacting the dogs? Or is it simply a case of depth perception? Perhaps the dogs cannot appreciate the depth of the drop on the other side. What doesn't support this theory, however, is the fact that a large number of Overton victims were long-nosed hunting dogs which have exceptionally good eyesight. Or maybe rather than bad eyesight, it's an optical illusion, where it looks as though there is a hedgerow or a small drop on the other side, and the dogs are simply miscalculating the extent of the drop. Or maybe it's just curiosity. The most popular theory is that the dogs are following the scent of something. Dogs have a stronger natural reaction to mink than, say, to squirrels or mice. Are there mink living under the bridge? This has been widely disputed by locals and indeed by Master of the Mid Wales and Glamorgan Mink Hounds, Clive Rees. But is the bridge simply a thin place? A place where the veil is at its thinnest? A place where reality and the paranormal, a place where life and death meet? Or maybe it has something to do with the White Lady. The first sighting of the White Lady was when two boys in their late teens were walking in the area. They were making their way home in the dark, and just as they crossed over the bridge, they noticed something. A white figure was moving through the trees. The boys watched as the figure moved through the trees and literally disappeared before their eyes. The boys fled. In the 1970s, taxi driver Barry Jackson was with a group of friends in the early hours of the morning when they saw a woman in white making her way through the misty fields. In 1988, a man who lived nearby named Gareth John looked out his window one night and was horrified to see a transparent misty woman in white drifting by his window. He could make out her Victorian dress and that her hair was up in a bun. Ian Fisher, the same dog walker who I mentioned previously in this episode, also had a run-in with the White Lady. Interestingly, he was walking in Overton with the dog Jess when she suddenly stopped, facing the castle with her heckles raised. When Ian looked, he could see the figure of a woman, all in white, standing in one of the windows of the castle. The castle had been long abandoned and boarded up. In 2014, a man named Thomas Trevorrow and his friends were walking across Overton Bridge when he looked up at the upper bay window of Overton Castle and saw a woman standing in the window. She was wearing a white dress and had her hair tied up into a bun. She was scowling down at them, clearly annoyed. The friends bolted back to their car, and as they drove off, a white mist flew across the car as if it had swooped towards them. They had no idea what this mist could have been, but they were terrified. In 2015, an 11-year-old girl was visiting Overton Castle when she saw the figure of a woman in the window watching her. She had no idea of the reputation of the castle and the previous sightings of the White Lady. But it's not just Lady Overton that haunts the area. In the 1980s, a man named Charles McNee was walking through the grounds of Overton. He had stopped by a waterfall when a strange-looking man approached him. He was wearing a tweed waistcoat and trousers, which appeared Victorian in style. He spoke with an extremely posh accent and had a hunting dog by his side. They had a small conversation and walked in their opposite directions, and when Charles turned around, the man was gone. He had disappeared. It was only later that Charles believed that he had had a conversation with the ghost of Baron Overton. Charles stated that his own dog showed absolutely no reaction to the strange man and his hunting dog. It is clear that something is happening at Overton. What that something is anyone's guess. Are the mysterious dog deaths related to the spectres that have been seen in and around the grounds? Or was the bridge cursed due to the Baron's ill-gotten gains? Whatever the case may be, even if there is a perfectly logical explanation, keep your dogs on a lead if you're walking in Overton. To be clear, that probably sounds like I'm saying that last bit like tongue-in-cheek. I'm really not. Like, genuinely do keep your dogs on a lead. Because regardless of whether or not you believe that this is paranormal or that there's a logical scientific explanation, this is happening. You know, it's definitely 100 dogs have thrown themselves off this bridge for whatever reason. And I'm just going to be clear here, okay? Buckle up, because my thoughts section on this document is almost as long as the bloody story itself, because there's so much to get through. I mean, like I said, this book was written by Paul Owens. That's where all my information came from. It is so well researched. Every single bit of information is referenced. And Paul Owens, if you ever do listen to this, I respect that. Like, well done, because it meant that I could also go and be like, oh wow, that's a really interesting side story. Here's a little side mission that I can go on while I'm researching this. And for all the animal lovers listening, I don't think there's anybody listening to this being like, oh woohoo, dogs are throwing themselves off a bridge, I'm really excited to hear that. No. I just want everyone to know that in this book there is a chapter that is all about the dogs who have thrown themselves off the bridge. But there is also a chapter about all the dogs that have survived. So it's not all doom and gloom. Okay. Some of those babies were absolutely fine. And I think there's something else that's important to mention as well. Like, I understand that Paul Owens was kind of trying to do as much research as possible and find as many stories as possible about Overton and seeing where things connected and blah, blah, blah. And I understand that. But I do feel like there was a lot of, this thing happened near Overton. Is this because of the bridge? Is this the same curse that is causing dogs to do this? And, you know, people who took their own lives on the estate, on the Overton estate, the kind of question was asked, did the same thing that caused these dogs to do this cause this person to take their own life? Similarly, the story about the father throwing his baby off the bridge, is a real story, and it's a really sad one. I thought it was really important to mention it because people reference that story a lot. But reading into the story, to me anyway, it was a man who I believe was very mentally unwell. And bridge or no bridge, he would have found a way to harm that baby, to be honest. I don't believe for a second there was any supernatural or paranormal forces that caused this man to do this. So this man believed that his baby was the Antichrist, and that it was his responsibility to get rid of the baby for that reason. So there is not a single part of me that even remotely considers that that was anything to do with the bridge or this apparent curse of the Overton land. sometimes people get very mentally unwell and do unthinkable things. And while it's sad and terrifying and none of us want to believe it, it is also a sad reality that our brains are fragile and they can make us do things that seem like they are completely unthinkable. And I can understand the want and the need to have a well-rounded story that's well-researched and that has lots of different reference points, etc. But I don't think that all of these deaths are, you know, something to do with some unseen force in Overton. Do I think there's strange things happening there? Absolutely, yes. So to give you an example, there was a description of a painting that is in Overton Castle. And this picture was a hunting dog that is battling a lion. That's what this painting is of. And the writer suggests or questions whether or not this was some sort of an omen as to what was going to happen in the future with dogs jumping off the bridge, like the dogs were having a battle with some unseen force. To me, I would say that lots of big posh houses had pictures of hunting dogs doing various hunting dog things, including hunting big animals. There was also lots of stuff about Hermes in this book, in this research, and a lot of stuff about Hermes in Baron Overton's life, which is interesting, as a man who was very much a Calvinist Christian, to have this great respect and reverence for Hermes, who was the god of alchemy and, interestingly, the lord of dogs. There was a lot of stuff about Hermes in this book and in Baron Overton's life, which I just thought was completely at odds with this Calvinist Christian identity that he was trying to portray. I find it very interesting. And I really do think that for Baron Overton, he lived this life where he wanted everyone to think that he was this saintly Christian man. But it does really seem like his real god was money. Like, that was what he actually worshipped. I mean, this crack of them having a go at alchemy, like that seems to have really happened, where they thought, we're going to start creating gold and, you know, we're going to smash it and other precious metals, and then we're just going to have all this money coming in. They already had all this money coming in off the backs of the suffering of men and women in Glasgow. But there seems to be a suggestion in this book that the dogs hurling themselves off the bridge is something to do with the god Hermes, that Hermes is responsible for the dogs doing this. And I just think, and I say this with no flippancy whatsoever, that if these gods are real in whatever capacity, I think they'd have a lot bigger things to do than be knocking around on a bridge in Scotland scrapping with dogs. I'm just putting that out there. And I think more so what this obsession with Hermes says about Baron Overton was that he was a man of serious contradictions. Apparently Overton House, the castle, was full of mad pictures of like angels and demons, which in my kind of armchair psychology opinion isn't exactly surprising, because he is living this life of contradictions. Surely the suffering of his workers was weighing on his conscience while he was going giving sermons to people about how to live life as a good Christian. And I really want to stress the point that I did not exaggerate what happened to those men in that factory. If you look up J&J White's chemical works, I mean, the stories about that place are absolutely diabolical. And Baron Overton and his father, they made those men work 7 days a week, 12 hours a day at least, for very little money, and basically gave them no lunch breaks. And the men that, or the food that the men consumed in the factory was obviously covered in chemicals, and therefore they were dying from both outside in and inside out from these chemicals. And for men that were so interested in God and the Bible, etc., etc., they made these people work a 7 day week. And if these men dared to take a couple of hours off to go to church on a Sunday, then their wages would be docked for the Monday, for the following day. So they would receive 1 day less in their wages, which is completely contradictory to the idea of keeping holy the Sabbath day. And at some point during the reign of the Overtons in this factory, a labour report was published which said you should give workers time off. It makes them more productive and it makes them out sick less and it keeps them healthier, etc., etc. So, you know, you should give them at least a day off a week. And Baron Overton literally said, I'm not giving these men a day off because they're just going to spend it in the pub. So they're going to spend it in my factory working. I mean, Christ on a bike, if they spent it in the pub, then let them, because they're having a pretty miserable time of it anyway. So this man, like, had some serious contradictions, is really what I'm saying. He was also a Freemason, and he had this huge emphasis on opposites in his life, which again is very fitting for a man who is a man of contradictions and just a general hypocrite. So he was all about the sun and the moon, and apparently that's why, or that's suggested to be why, they changed the date for the opening of the bridge. So the date of the opening of the bridge on the stone is the 5th of June, but it was actually opened on the 7th of June. And the belief is that he actually wanted it to be opened on a full moon, because that was in line with Freemason thinking about the big emphasis on opposites. And I do think he was genuinely a really fascinating and probably very mixed up man. And I think at some point he did see himself as being akin to God, you know, referring to himself as the I Am. You know, that's a pretty big claim to make about yourself. So I think he's just a very interesting man and a very mixed up man. And there is a part of me that would like to think, hey, I hope you did feel guilt about what you did to the men in those factories, about what you did to the land all around the River Clyde. I hope you did feel guilt. I hope it did weigh on your mind at nighttime. And the last thing that I sort of thought was important to mention in relation to the research in this book that was about Overton Bridge is there was a lot of talk about psychics coming to visit the area and psychics coming to visit the castle, etc., etc. And one psychic came to visit the bridge, and she talked all about a man called Edward. And she said that Edward was really angry. He had been on a horse and he had a horn that he used to control and summon his hunting dogs. And while he was blowing this horn, one of the dogs bit his horse and the horse reared and bucked him off and he hit his head and died. And she was saying, you know, he is angry and this is what's causing the dogs to die. And later, a long time later, maybe a couple of years later, a group of psychics picked up the name of Edward and said that Edward was a man who was angry and that he had died on the property. Apparently there's no record of an Edward having been there. But then again, you just never know with the lives of the rich and the wealthy. You never know who came and went to the castle and things that happened and may have been kept quiet or may not have been reported in the way that perhaps they should have been. And like I said, there's no evidence for this. There's no record of this man. So I didn't include it in the main body of the story because I thought I don't want to perpetuate just rumor. And you know what I do think about this story? I think the sightings of the Baron Overton and the sightings of the White Lady are really interesting. When you look up Lady Overton, she is a woman who was generally dressed in white. She used to walk the grounds every day. She had a particular route named Lady Overton's Walk. Like, she loved Overton Estate and she always wore her hair on the top of her head in a bun. So she would have been quite distinctive looking. And it does feel like people are seeing her spirit wandering the grounds. Equally, it seems like Baron Overton might also be wandering the grounds. Like this man, Charles McNee, who said that he had a conversation with this strange looking man. And he said the conversation was basically like, morning, how are you? It's a lovely day. Hope you're not too busy. Like a kind of a exchanging pleasantries kind of conversation. And then he realized, when he turned around, shit, that man has vanished into thin air. And I don't think that was a real man. I think that was a ghost. There was another story about a group of friends who were camping. And they, one of them woke up in the night and there was a gap between the bottom of their tent and the grass. And he heard somebody walking around their tent and saw a pair of kind of older style brown boots standing outside the tent. And then they suddenly disappeared. The boots did. And they thought that they had also experienced the Baron's ghost. And that part of this story of the ghost of the Overtons still knocking around, I feel like that's not too far removed from possibility. If ghosts exist, these two people lived a life that was fraught with contradictions. And hopefully, I say hopefully, that's probably unfair, but you'd like to think they felt some sort of guilt and sorrow for the suffering of the people that were making them all this money. You'd like to think that they did. I know that sometimes people are very good at compartmentalizing things and maybe they didn't feel any guilt, But regardless of all of that, Overton Estate was really important to them. The bridge was incredibly important to them. The castle was incredibly important to them. The grounds were incredibly important to them. Maybe they've never left. Maybe they just can't bear to leave the thing that they love so much. And in regards to the dogs on Overton Bridge, I don't think the White Lady or Baron Overton have anything to do with the dogs jumping off the bridge, because by all accounts in life, both the Baron and Lady Overton really loved dogs and had dogs in and around the castle all the time and really looked after their dogs well, it seemed. So it wouldn't make sense that in death they would be driving dogs off the bridge. Do I equally think that it's Hermes, god of alchemy, lord of dogs, that is doing this? No, because I think that if Hermes was real, unlikely to be hanging around on a bridge in Scotland, to be really frank. Honestly, I think this is probably something natural. I think there is some sort of perfect storm on that bridge of natural causes that is causing these dogs to jump, whether it's that there is some sort of optical illusion and they believe there isn't this big drop on the other side. Maybe that's the case. Maybe it is mink. Apparently the locals and the mink experts have said no, it probably isn't, because locals say there's no mink in the area, or at least they've never seen them. And according to the mink expert that I mentioned earlier in the story, Clive Rees, he said that the scent of mink isn't particularly stronger than other creatures, and it doesn't last for like hours or days. It's a scent that will, you know, be on a tree stump for a couple of minutes and then it's gone. So I do think it's something weird and natural. Maybe it's some sort of infrasound. Maybe it's an optical illusion. Maybe it is just dogs getting overexcited and jumping over the bridge and not realizing the depth of the fall on the other side. I don't know. But I would like to know your thoughts on this bananas series of stories that somehow apparently all tie together. Thank you so much for listening to today's episode. And if this all sounded a bit hectic and muddled, firstly, it was, because it was a lot of stuff mushed together in this research. And secondly, I am recovering from a migraine, so my brain is also a little bit muddled and hectic at the moment. Thank you so much for listening to this episode. Remember, if you would like to send in your story, you can do so by emailing it to reallifeghoststoriespodcast@gmail.com. You can also check out the website, reallifeghoststoriespodcast.com. And if you are desperate for some extra content, you can subscribe to the Patreon. That is patreon.com/reallifeghoststories, where for $5 a month or $2 a month, you get access to heaps of extra content, as well as every single main and mini episode completely ad-free. And on that note, I shall see you next time.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.